Hi, this is Serious Feather Arts with your host, Brett Gregory. This evening, we're going to be travelling back in time to explore the origins and development of a special place which lies at the very heart of vintage Americana, the drive-in cinema. Our guide on this unique journey will be an honorary visiting fellow from the University of Leicester in the UK and author of a new book called The Drive-In, Outdoor Cinema in 1950s America and the Popular Imagination.
Hi, my name is Guy Barefoot. I'm a historian of American cinema, mainly of the 1930s, 40s and 50s, and that has increasingly meant looking at the film programme, where films were shown, who watched them, and sometimes what else audiences did at the cinema.
What originally attracted you to the subject of the drive-in cinema?
I started research for my book, which should be out in December, around 5 years ago. I was initially interested in the origin of the drive-in's reputation as a passion pit. What soon became clear was that there were two dominant, occasionally overlapping, but largely contradictory views of the drive-in. For some, drive-ins and drive-in movies meant audiences in their teens or just after, and exploitation films, that is, films with sensationalist material or marketing. In the 1950s, from the recollection of fans to overviews of film exhibition, associated it with family visits to the cinema and tended to say less about the films than that, for instance, there were drive-ins where people could get their laundry done while the movie played.
Their laundry? I can't think of a more rebellious act.
Interesting though that was, I wanted to know more about where these cinemas were in relation to urban centres, who went to them, what films they showed, or whether it was true that, as the most substantial book on the topic claimed, no one in the 50s or 60s went to the drive-in to see the movie.
I can imagine. So when did the first drive-in open in North America, and who were the enterprising architects behind it?
The generally accepted starting date of the drive-in was the 6th of June 1933, when Richard Holinshed Jr. opened his drive-in just outside Camden, New Jersey. There'd been outdoor screenings before that date, notably at what were called air domes. There were even occasions when people may have watched films while sitting in their cars. But Hollingshead and his business partner, Willie Warren Smith, were distinctive in taking out a patent for showing films outdoors in front of a series of ramps designed to give the occupants of parked cars an unobstructed view of the screen. Hollingshead argued that that turned the car into a private theatre box, allowing people to talk, eat, smoke, or bring along their noisy children without disrupting others, and that it brought films to people who might not go to an indoor cinema.
Genius! What could possibly go wrong?
Drive-ins, at least those from the 1950s or earlier, tend to be associated with films that were old, shown in poor quality prints, low budget, or not from the Hollywood major studios.
Oh.
The films that they did show were not screened or heard in the best conditions. Sound was a particular problem, and only partly improved after the Second World War when drive-ins introduced individual speakers attached to car windows. Surrounding light from the sky or neighbouring buildings did not help the clarity of the screen image. It didn't help either if it was raining, and mosquitoes were another problem.
Mosquitoes? I see. And what else?
Drive-ins were limited by the fact that they could not show films while it was daylight, and outside the South by the fact that for much of the year it was too cold to show films at all. But the growth in the number of drive-ins in the late 1940s and the 1950s meant that there were summer periods when more people in the US were watching films outdoors than indoors. While some treated the drive-in business as a gimmick before the Second World War, it had become too big to be dismissed as that after the war.
The resilience of popular culture. And the tickets must have been much cheaper than those for indoor cinemas.
The admission charge did tend to be relatively low, and many drive-ins let children in for free, to the annoyance of distributors who made their money from taking a percentage of the box office take. In comparison with indoor cinemas, a higher proportion of drive-in takings tended to come from food and drink sales. In the 1950s, most drive-ins also had a children's playground, sometimes elaborate facilities with, for example, a miniature train. In effect, some drive-ins were amusement parks.
Fascinating. And what were the type of films screened at these drive-ins in the 1950s?
The drive-ins that I've looked at from the 1950s tended to have programmes that were similar to neighbouring indoor cinemas. That is, they showed a lot of westerns and other action films, but also films that had won the Oscars that year, Disney films, other Hollywood films, and non-Hollywood films with exploitation potential, including the occasional film from overseas. My examination of 1958 box office records for three drive-ins in Little Rock, Arkansas, revealed that the Brigitte Bardot film And God Created Woman took the most money, narrowly beating the biblical epic, The Ten Commandments. However, Hollingshead's drive-in tended to show films from Poverty Row Studios, that is, studios that specialised in low-budget genre films, and the odd British film. In some areas, there were drive-ins that showed Spanish-language films. The overall point is that the drive-in programme was broader than has generally been assumed, and while they did not compete with downtown first-run cinemas, over time, more drive-ins showed films at the same time as other cinemas.
Interesting. Do you have a specific example?
One of the drive-ins I looked at in Phoenix, Arizona, started out in 1951 as the Twin Open Air, with one screen showing westerns and other action films, and what they called a variety programme on the other screen. It was then split into two drive-ins. One was renamed Acres of Fun. By the end of the 1950s, it was screening double bills, such as I Was a Teenage Werewolf and Invasion of the Saucer Men, as well as films from Bambi to Some Like It Hot. The other was renamed The Peso. It showed Spanish-language films, mainly Mexican films.
And were there any complaints from local people when these drive-in cinemas suddenly started springing up in their area?
The relationship between drive-ins and local communities also varied. If you look at local newspapers, you will certainly come across reports of objections to a proposed drive-in and complaints about behaviour at the drive-in or what was being shown at the drive-in. Exhibitors, however, often did their best to integrate their business into the local community, whether by organising children's events or becoming involved in the community in other ways.
These days, most people associate 1950s drive-in cinemas with rude and rowdy teenagers. But in historical terms, this isn't strictly true, is it?
Throughout the 1950s, exhibitors insisted that their main audience was the family, which generally meant couples with young children. Overall, at least before the 1960s, teenagers formed a minority of the cinema audience and did not necessarily prefer outdoor to indoor moviegoing. However, they were growing into a significant minority, and exhibitors who emphasised the family audience were in part attempting to downplay the reputation the drive-in had from the beginning as a dating venue or passion pit. So yes, teenagers who had access to a car did go to the drive-in, and in the second half of the 1950s, films aimed at teenagers were shown at drive-ins as well as indoor cinemas, though they made up a relatively small part of the programme.
And what other types of audience did the exhibitors accommodate?
As well as emphasising the family audience, some exhibitors and commentators wrote of the drive-in as a place where different generations and income groups could mix, even that the drive-ins were more welcoming to black audiences than other cinemas. If that was true in some places, it was not elsewhere. Into the 1960s, there were drive-ins that segregated black and white audiences, others that excluded black audiences. There were a small number of drive-ins for black audiences. There were ways in which drive-ins were different, but they were part of a nation in which segregation was widespread to the extent that it did not generally need to be explicitly stated.
Sobering thoughts. Anyway, what about the representation of drive-in cinemas in wider culture, particularly on screen?
The drive-in has played a role in Hollywood films ever since the 1949 film White Heat, when James Cagney's Cody Jarrett evaded the law by turning into Burbank's Sunbelt Drive-In. It's also evoked in numerous song lyrics, various novels, and photographs from Robert Frank's mid-1950s drive-in movie Detroit, to later images of abandoned drive-ins. What's fascinating about these is their differences. Almost from the start, drive-ins had a disruptive, or at least disreputable, reputation. They've increasingly been viewed with nostalgia. But even that nostalgia has different sides. It can be for an imagined 1950s innocence. Drive-in scenes in films such as The Lords of Flatbush and Grease were part of a 1970s trend that looked back to the 1950s teenagers in different ways. And in the 1970s and 1980s, the drive-in was also becoming increasingly associated with horror and other forms of exploitation cinema, and, as others have noted, the subsequent circulation of such films as drive-in movies on DVD or other formats has itself been a form of nostalgia. Drive-in films set in the past also lend themselves to coming-of-age narratives, whether that means children in the 1996 film Frankenstein and Me sneaking into a drive-in screening of Night of the Living Dead, or teenagers meeting at a Cape Cod drive-in in the summer of 1991 in the 2017 film Hot Summer Nights. Drive-ins also feature on screen as part of contemporary roadside America, the sort of place a car might drive in 1949 in White Heat, or in, say, Thunderbolt and Lightfoot in 1974.
Thunderbolt and Lightfoot is a great film. Thoroughly enjoyed that when I was a kid.
I guess the fact that they've been part of the actual landscape of roadside America and part of the experience of growing up for many people explains their screen presence, though that can vary from the opening shot of Midnight Cowboy, which shows the blank screen of an almost empty Texas drive-in in daylight, to the crane shot of the neon-lit drive-in sign in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
I fear the beginning of the end is about to arrive.
Published figures suggest the drive-in capacity and takings fluctuated, but overall were increasing into the 1970s, even though the number of drive-ins had decreased. Drive-ins closed more rapidly in the 1980s. In part, that was because owners of drive-ins built out of town on what were in the late 1940s or the 1950s relatively low-cost land could get a quicker return from selling to a late 20th century property developer, particularly when urban expansion meant that the surrounding area was no longer open country. Beyond that, an increasing emphasis on R and in some instances X-rated films was accompanied by a declining family audience, while over time indoor multiplexes and different video formats for home viewing attracted more of the youth market. It may also be that there were more potential dating venues after the 1950s, while smaller cars with bucket seats did not help those who wanted the drive-in to live up to its passion pit reputation.
Such a shame. The rise of capitalism at the expense of the community. Anyway, thank you so much, Guy, for taking us on such an enlightening journey into the past. I'm sure you've conjured up a lot of strong cinematic memories for many of our listeners.
Thank you.
And good luck with your book, The Drive-In, Outdoor Cinema in 1950s America and the Popular Imagination, published by Bloomsbury in December 2023. This has been Serious Feather Arts, and I've been Brett Gregory. Cheers.